Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1361, Birds of a Feather. This is being recorded on November 23rd of the year 2024. Once again, this program, like its predecessor, is being recorded in the observation of the assassination of President Kennedy, the 61st anniversary of which was yesterday, Friday, November 22nd of 2024. The original assassination, or the assassination, took place on a Friday, November 22nd, 1963. Now, we have been speaking about D.H. Byrd, David H. Byrd, Dry Hole Byrd, a man with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. And we began in part one reading, we read a wonderful article by Jerry Kuzmarov from Covert Action Information Bulletin from November 21st of 2024, and then another wonderful article from Russ Baker from his Who, What, Why blog, the JFK assassination 60 years later. This from November 15th of 2023. Russ Baker, I was privileged to interview the brilliant Russ Baker for 6 hours in regard to his book, Family of Secrets, and we've also done other interviews as well. Now, skipping down into this second article, JFK assassination, 60 years later, crucial alibi dismantled. And this is talking about Admiral, or rather David H. Byrd, Freudian slip, because he was related to Admiral Richard Byrd of Operation High Jump. More about that later. And skipping into Russ Baker's article, where was Byrd that day, really? And this, referring to November 22nd, 1963. Any serious investigation into JFK's assassination would have proved Oswald's path to being in the building that day. There was a central mystery of the assassination, but the Dallas police, the FBI, and the Warren Commission, while going through the motions of scrutinizing how Oswald landed the job when he did, concluded it was all just an uncanny coincidence that a guy with an inclination to assassinate, how many of those are there, unwittingly got the perfect opportunity to do so, which meant they failed to examine Byrd's ownership of the building, which meant they failed to interview him and ask him whether he knew Oswald, whether he knew how Oswald had been hired, etc. And, of course, they never asked Byrd where he was when he learned that his own building had harbored Kennedy's killer. To this day, as I've said, Byrd has eluded scrutiny. But given the cataclysmic import of the events of November 22nd, 1963, it's surely not too late to open that inquiry. Question number one, where was Byrd that day? Answer, we don't really know, but I've unearthed some strong hints about where he wasn't. Working with a ghostwriter, Byrd later established a vanity autobiography, although he makes some efforts to enliven his life story with anecdotes that might interest general readers. Nowhere does he mention November 22nd, his ownership of the Texas School Book Depository building, or his presumed consternation on learning the building's role in the crime of the century. In fact, about the JFK assassination, he says precisely nothing. To me, that's passing strange. Looking deeper into his whereabouts on and around that tragic day, here's one thing I found. There is no evidence that he was in Dallas. We wouldn't expect there to be, because he soon put the word out that he'd been away. But on the other hand, what I also found that definitely roused my curiosity was an apparent effort by Byrd and associates to plant stories about him that pointed to his being thousands of miles away from Dallas at that time, on a hunting safari in Mozambique, a place he had never been to before. Why do that? And what was more curious still, the closer I looked into the tale of the safari, the more it seemed that Byrd, with a little help from his friends, had made up that whole story, for reasons that a JFK assassination investigator can only speculate about. I'll take you through the details of what I found, and you can decide for yourself if there's a plausible, benign explanation. And then Russ Baker goes into the fact that Byrd was one of the founders, or the founder, of the Civil Air Patrol, and it was David Ferry and his unit of the Civil Air Patrol, which certainly was functioning as an adjunct to covert operations, as we looked at in, among other programs, the long series of 25 one-hour interviews that we did with Jinji Ajemio about his book, Destiny Betrayed. And it was Lee Harvey Oswald, who was a member of David Ferry's Civil Air Patrol unit, as was Barry Seal, one of the top Iran-Contra drug pilots. And I will link to an article, discussion of that we had from the late brilliant Daniel Hopsicker and his madcowprod.com website. More context. Continuing with Russ Baker's article, skipping down. With that as context-setting background, let's return to the question of why Byrd might have gone to so much trouble to create the impression that he was in Africa hunting elephants on November 22, 1963. Well, for one thing, his ownership of the Texas School Book Depository building might have shined an uncomfortable spotlight on his activities around the time of the assassination. Having owned this building for decades and being hands-on, he knew the innards of the structure better than anyone else. This is important when you consider how all aspects of the building have been examined and re-examined over the years in an effort to nail down what actually happened when the President of the United States was gunned down in broad daylight on the street in front of the Texas School Book Depository. Because Oswald, the sole suspect, was killed in police custody 2 days after the assassination, and so never had a chance to tell in detail exactly what he knew, the investigation into the murder revolved around physical evidence at the crime scene, with prime focus on Byrd's building. To reconstruct what happened, investigators had to consider such details as the location of the passenger and freight elevators, and which elevator went up to which floors, the layout of the stairwells, and other potential hiding places, the distances, and times it would take for a shooter or shooters to fire their weapons, hide their guns, and descend undetected a number of floors so as to be seen standing, as Oswald was, on the second floor, calmly holding a soda, which, when spotted by other employees and a police officer in the building just moments after Kennedy was hit. If I were running a clandestine operation out of that building, I'd want Harold Byrd by my side offering intimate details as I was dealing with the police radio, the movements of various law enforcement agencies into the building, and so on. I certainly would not want him far away, unreachable, in some steamy African savanna. Indeed, Byrd's purported trip came in the last weeks of the local hunting season when the heat typically became oppressive. Even the safari camp advertised that it closed as of December 1st. But I also wouldn't want him visible in Dallas doing anything publicly. On the other hand, if I were Byrd and I were involved in something of this nature, the first thing I'd worry about is covering my own A blank blank. In short, I'd need a good story should anyone ask questions. Back in the days where there were no cell phones or other modern means of tracking someone away from, quote, civilization, unquote, what better story than being away on an African safari, especially for someone already known to be an avid hunter? And the next section, shot by Harold Byrd on December 7th, 1963. It's not as if there aren't some pieces of evidence that Byrd was on safari in Africa for several weeks in late 1963, but on closer examination, this evidence is revealed to be highly dubious. Consider photos to an online gallery by Christian von Alvensleben, a nephew of the owner of the safari camp, who worked there as a photographer. One shows a man that the photographer was told was, quote, Byrd, unquote. Von Alvensleben remembers him and a companion arriving in early November of 1963 and staying over a month. We cannot reproduce those safari photos on this page for copyright reasons. Sorry about that. But the links take you directly to the photos in question. Take a close look at, quote, Byrd, unquote, the man with a mustache smoking a cigar, and compare it with the ones below whom we consider to be the real Byrd. Notice especially the eyes. His eyes recede beneath puffy upper lids. His face appears fairly flat, with the brow, ridge, forehead, and eyes all seem to be almost on the same plane. His brows are narrow and wispy. The eyes of our presumed impostor are very different. The brow ridge protrudes more, and his brows are bushy and sharply arched. His ears also seem different, and he doesn't seem to have the real Byrd's somewhat pointed chin. He's also less rotund than Byrd was at this stage by almost any measure, This is simply not the same person. I sent the photo of a mustachioed man to several people who knew Byrd. None of them thought it was he. Also, the real Byrd was a proud hunter who, like most hunters, routinely posed for pictures next to his trophies. Yet in the online photo gallery, we see a picture of a dead elephant lying on its side with two Mozambican guides holding its ear aloft. On the ear is painted, quote, "Shot by Harold Byrd, December 7th, 1963, unquote, and no Harold Byrd standing beside it. What kind of hunter does that? Arguably, only one who's keen to keep his face out of the picture while creating the impression that he, or rather the person being impersonated, was there. In fact, the purported Byrd was so keen to leave a false trail that, von Adlensleben tells us, throughout his visit the presumably false Byrd had a brush and a can of paint stowed in the Land Rover during his hunting sorties, apparently waiting for a chance to paint Byrd's name on something big enough. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the guy who presented himself as Byrd, arriving at the hunting camp 2 or 3 weeks before the assassination, was an imposter. And who could have sent him except Byrd, or people acting on his behalf, to substantiate the story that Byrd was nowhere near Dallas in late November? The more safari photos you look at, the more doubts arise. The purported Byrd showed up with a companion, an American with a southern accent who called himself Thomas May. However, a Dallas Morning News article on January 19, 1964, which mentioned Byrd's hunting trip, said that his companion was Dr. Vanda Davidson, D-A-V-I-D-S-O-N, a leading Dallas gynecologist. But von Adlensleben, the photographer, reports no Davidson with Byrd. Period photos of Davidson show that he is not the same man as the, quote, Thomas May, unquote, who appears in von Adlensleben's photos. Von Adlensleben, full Mozambique gallery here, recalls that May described himself as a former Marine colonel, now a school book writer or editor. Extensive searches have found no historical record of someone with that name fitting that description. So it looks like both hunters were using false names. Point of information, wonder if he wrote any books that wound up in the PSBB. Continuing. For what it's worth, the weather in that part of Mozambique in November tends to be searing hot. A 1990s aid project in the same district once recorded a 117 degree Fahrenheit at that time of year. This hunting camp received very few visitors that late in the season. Although these two mystery men managed to hunt despite the heat, it's hardly the time of year a rich hunter would choose to go there. Whoever the two men on safari were, they weren't too dismayed when news of the JFK assassination reached the camp by shortwave radio broadcast. Quote, Thomas May, unquote, brought everyone around in drinks. And, quote, Byrd, unquote, made no move to rush back to the U.S. to assist the authorities in their investigation, which centered on his building. The implications of someone in Byrd's position going to such lengths to create a false alibi covering the period his building was used for an assassination are, frankly, chilling. It's always possible, of course, that one or another of these head-scratching anomalies has some innocent or alternate explanation. Maybe Byrd was actually away on a secret love tryst. Still, the links between Byrd and the JFK assassination are so extensive and so prima facie questionable that it's hard to believe the redoubtable Mr. Byrd wasn't more thoroughly investigated at the time. I'm thinking, of course, about his strategically located building, his financial and personal ties to major figures in the military complex, his connections to key figures in the JFK assassination saga, and above all, his close ties to Johnson, which together could have made him indispensable to a possible assassination plot. What could he have been doing that would explain such an elaborate stunt of sending an imposter to Africa to paint his name on elephants? We'll be delighted if anyone comes forward with solid new information about Byrd's whereabouts in November of 1963, or who recognizes the false Byrd or Thomas May. The real Byrd, by the way, made millions on his military contracting investments after his friend Johnson ascended to the presidency and quickly escalated his involvement in Vietnam. Oh, yes, another curious detail. sometime after 1963. Byrd had the sixth-floor window from which Oswald supposedly fired his kill shots at Kennedy removed from his book depository building and installed in his banquet room. It remained there hung like a trophy for more than two decades. Well, again, who was in that Mozambican safari? It does not appear to have been B.H. Byrd, and I think Russ Baker's ruminations are on target, and no pun intended, and that was not actually B.H. Byrd. Some more information, and this fleshes out, I think, the milieu, not only surrounding the JFK assassination, but frankly, that was 61 years ago, and in my opinion, the fruits of that event really, they began to grow on that day, and it's harvest time, folks. A wonderful piece of work was done by Dan Alcorn. He is an assassination researcher at the Assassination Archives and Research Center. And he has an article here called Dan Alcorn, Byrd, von Alvensleben and the Beautiful Report, subtitled The AARC Presents a New Series of Lectures Commemorating and Honoring the Legacy of President Kennedy, the Inspirational Meaning of His Term of Office, and the Consequences of His Assassination 61 Years Ago. In the words of the distinguished British scholar Malcolm Blunt, quote, Jesus Christ, what we lost when we lost that man, unquote. This by Dan Alcorn. Earlier this year, the Assassination Archives and Research Center filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court to bring a Freedom of Information case before that court. The case involved a Freedom of Information request for individuals that were related to the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. There are three subjects of the Freedom of Information request. The first is David Harold Byrd, who was the owner of the Texas School Book Depository Building in 1963. That's where the shots were said to have been fired at the president. The second subject of the request is Werner von Alvensleben. Werner calls the couple D.E. capital W-E-R-N-E-R, small V-O-N, last name capital A-L-V-E-N-S-L-E-B-E-N, who had been an intelligence asset, a double agent for the U.S. OSS in World War II, and who was associating with David Harold Byrd, the owner of the Book Depository Building, around the time of the assassination. The third subject of the request was the Doolittle Report in 1954. And the next section is called General James Doolittle. President Eisenhower commissioned Jimmy Doolittle, a World War II hero. By the way, he was the guy who led the famous raid on Tokyo called 30, that was commemorated as 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. General James Doolittle. President Eisenhower commissioned Jimmy Doolittle, a World War II hero, to examine the covert activities of the CIA with the goal of making them more effective and efficient. Jimmy Doolittle conducted a fairly quick review of CIA activities, and they made certain recommendations. This is of interest because Jimmy Doolittle and David Harold Byrd were substantial friends, according to General Doolittle, and so that is another connection that we have that we are interested in. We have not been able to get access to the operational files of the CIA. They refused to give us access to any of the operational files about the three subjects of the investigation. This is important to us because we have sourcing from the Dallas Morning News that Werner von Alvensleben was in Dallas in late 1963 as the guest of David Harold Byrd. And this is important as we get into the background of Werner von Alvensleben, because at one time earlier in his career in 1933, he had been an assassin for Heinrich Himmler, the Nazi leader in Hitler's Germany, and that makes it relevant to exploring what was going on in 1963. Because David Harold Byrd visited Hitler before World War II and found him quite likable and his policies sensible. One more time. We have not been able to get access to the operational files of the CIA. They refused to give us access to any of the operational files about these three subjects of the investigation. This is important to us because we have sourcing from the Dallas Morning News that Werner von Alvensleben was in Dallas in late 1963 as the guest of David Harold Byrd. And this is important as we get into the background of Werner von Alvensleben, because at one time earlier in his career in 1933, he had been an assassin for Heinrich Himmler, the Nazi leader in Hitler's Germany, and that makes it relevant to exploring what was going on in 1963. Again, this Werner von Alvensleben was in Dallas in late 1963 as the guest of David Harold Byrd. Note that Werner von Alvensleben, an assassin for Heinrich Himmler's SS and a double agent for the OSS through Portugal. And by the way, Portugal was at that point in time and for quite some time afterward governed by Henrique Salazar, a fascist dictator who lent support to Francisco Franco's efforts in the Spanish Civil War to establish the fascist dictatorship in Spain. But again, Pope Werner von Alvensleben was in Dallas in late 1963 as the guest of David Harold Byrd. Continuing. Back to a little background of the owner of the Book Depository building. It is surprising that not all of these facts had been known until this point, because we're 61 years beyond the assassination, yet here are key relevant facts that are still emerging. I saw the name of David Harold Byrd on the historical plaque on the side of the building, the School Book Depository building, when I was in Dallas maybe 20, 25 years ago, and I noticed David Harold Byrd, B-Y-R-B, spelled like the famous political family in Virginia, the Virginia Political Byrds, who basically controlled the politics of the state in question for almost the entire 20th century. When I saw that name, again, BYRB, I thought they couldn't possibly be connected in any way, but I was wrong. It turns out they were related. They were distant cousins, but they were related, and they developed a relationship through David Harold Byrd, the owner of the Book Depository building, who became a financial supporter of the activities of Admiral Richard Byrd, who was the brother of U.S. Senator Harry F. Byrd. Now, Admiral Richard Byrd also commanded something called Operation High Jump. That was a U.S. Navy expedition to Antarctica in 1946-1947. One of the people who was there was a guy named H. Keith Thompson. That is to say, he was with Admiral Byrd on that expedition. It was a big expedition. It was like some 70 ships. But H. Keith Thompson was an agent for the Sicherheitsdienst, that was the SS intelligence service during World War II, and he also was handling public relations for Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, in the aftermath of the JFK assassination. There have been many allegations that Admiral Richard Byrd and his expedition encountered UFOs in Antarctica. Those have never been substantiated, but I also would not necessarily write those off for reasons we'll touch on later. Continuing, who was David Harold Byrd, the owner of the Book Depository building? We know that he was the founder of the Civil Air Patrol in the entire country, and he served as one of the leaders of the Civil Air Patrol on the national level. He was on the National Executive Committee, which had about 11 people on it. He was the vice chairman for a good period of time and chairman at another time. This is relevant because Lee Harvey Oswald was a cadet in the Civil Air Patrol when he was in New Orleans in high school, and that has led some to believe that there might be some meaning in Oswald's membership in the Civil Air Patrol. Well, again, the leader of his unit was David Ferry, principally involved in the JFK assassination, and also Barry Seal, one of the top Iran-Contra drug smugglers, also speculated about as possibly flying a getaway plane for the JFK assassination on November 20th, for some of the actual assassins in the JFK assassination on 11-22-63. Continuing. Why are we interested in David Harold Byrd as the owner of the School Book Depository building? It's because after the assassination, Byrd ordered the sniper's window removed from the building and set up in his mansion in Dallas as a display item. And it was reported that various social events thereafter occurred in front of that window. As seen in photographs of the window in Byrd's house, there are various depictions of the single bullet theory that were taped to the window panes, and it's clearly made as a display item that supports the official Warren Commission version of the assassination and the single bullet theory. As I mentioned, we are also interested in Brin's relationship with Jimmy Doolittle. Jimmy Doolittle turns out to have been a high-ranking intelligence advisor to President Eisenhower and a substantial friend of David Harold Byrd. Among other people, our search has found were known to David H. Byrd was Ernest Ubet, U-B-E-T, and he was the number two man in the Luftwaffe to Hermann Göring in Nazi Germany. Byrd describes Ubet as a close friend in Byrd's autobiography, and Ubet was in charge of research and development for the Luftwaffe, which is the theme that seems to run through some of these connections, the forward-looking research and development process for aviation and aerospace. Aviation was the basis for the relationship between Byrd and Ernst Ubet of the Luftwaffe, again, apparently in charge of R&D for the Luftwaffe. Question, was there any link between B.H. Byrd, his relationship with Ernst Ubet, and Admiral Richard Byrd, Operation High Jump, H.K. Thompson, and the stories that Admiral Byrd also encountered, quote, UFOs, unquote, at a Nazi base in Antarctica. Again, that has the allegation that there was a Nazi base in Antarctica has been brooded about for quite some time. Parts of Antarctica are ice-free because of volcanic activity. Doesn't mean there's a Nazi base there or was. Doesn't mean there were UFOs there. But I do ask that question. And was there any relationship between that and the fact that a secret Reichsdienst agent, an SS intelligence agent, H.K. Thompson, who later handled public relations for Marguerite Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, in the aftermath of the JFK assassination, is there any relationship there? Continuing. And bear in mind that Werner von Alvensleben, a former SS sniper or assassin, and a double agent for the OSS, he was in Dallas with Byrd in late 1963. Our interest in Werner von Alvensleben is that he ran a big game hunting concession in Portuguese East Africa called Safarilandia. This was said to be the largest big game hunting operation in Africa. Von Alvensleben had gone to Africa in World War II, where he ultimately served as a double agent for the OSS in Portuguese East Africa. After the war, he tried to come to the U.S., but he was denied permission to migrate to the U.S., and he stayed in Portuguese East Africa and created the big game hunting operation. He had an elite clientele. King Juan Carlos of Spain was an example. Stavros Niarchos, the shipping magnate, was a client. David Harold Byrd was reported to be a client at Safarilandia, and the Dallas Morning News reported that Byrd was at Safarilandia on November 22, 1963. Again, I wonder if von Alvensleben was in fact a double agent for the OSS in Africa. Why was he denied entry to the U.S.? I don't know, but I think it's a question worth asking here. There was some corroborating evidence for that in the form of a photograph of an elephant with writing on it saying, quote, shot by Harold Byrd, December 7th, 1963. This is part of a photo series that was produced on the hunt that Byrd was said to have attended. And this photo series was created by von Alvensleben's nephew, Christian von Alvensleben, and he has posted it on the Internet under the website as, quote, Mozambique, 1963, unquote. Again, we spoke about some of the contradictions there in that wonderful article by Russ Baker. Continuing. However, this photo series raises some troubling questions. One, is that Christian von Alvensleben shows a photograph that he identifies as David Harold Byrd arriving at Safarilandia on the November 22nd, 1963 safari hunt. But the person in the photograph is not David Harold Byrd. It's just clearly not him. It's an older gentleman, but not David Harold Byrd. We don't know who this individual is. There are no photographs in the Christian von Alvensleben photo series that are identifiable as David Harold Byrd, nor is he in the photograph with the elephant that's been shot. David Harold Byrd is not in that photograph, though it says the animal was shot by him. So it has raised a question about whether David Harold Byrd was in fact in Safarilandia in Portuguese East Africa at the time of the assassination, as there seemed to be another individual there identified as David Harold Byrd. There's also someone in the photo series named Tom May, who's identified as a Dallas school book publisher, and it's not known who this individual is as well. Again, a Dallas school book publisher. Interesting coincidence, if that's what it is. Continuing. In researching Werner von Alvensleben and his big game hunting operation, I came across the information that von Alvensleben's favorite rifle was the Mannlicher Schomauer rifle. That's Mannlicher as in Mannlicher, Kakana and the Schomauer, capital S-C-H-O-E-M-A-U-E-R. Of course, I was familiar with the Mannlicher Kakana because that's the rifle said to have been used to kill President Kennedy. I wasn't aware of the Mannlicher Schomauer. I did some research, and it turns out that the Mannlicher Schomauer was the finest hunting rifle of that era. It was an Austrian rifle. It was said on numerous sites devoted to guns and ammunition that the Mannlicher Schomauer and the Mannlicher Kakana rifles used essentially identical ammunition. Very difficult to tell the two cartridges apart. There are sources among the blogs that say the ammunition, some ammunition, was manufactured with the purpose of being used interchangeably between the two rifles. Well, this rifle was the favorite rifle of Werner von Alvensleben, the big game hunter. Again, he was apparently in Dallas with B.H. Byrd in late 1963. Continuing here, let me recap some of the previous sentences for continuity purposes. It was said on numerous sites devoted to guns and ammunition that the Mannlicher Schomauer and Mannlicher Kakana rifles used essentially identical ammunition. Very difficult to tell the two cartridges apart. There are sources among the blogs that say the ammunition, some ammunition, was manufactured with the purpose of being used interchangeably between the two rifles. Well, the rifle was the favorite rifle of Werner von Alvensleben, the big game hunter. It was also favored by other big game hunters of the time because of its ability to stop large animals. That was it. That was what it was particularly effective for. In researching the Mannlicher Schomauer rifle, I came across testimony to the Warren Commission. It came up before the Warren Commission in the following way. Warren Commissioner John McCoy was at a session in which the FBI ballistics expert Robert Fraser testified. John McCoy interrupted the questioning to ask his own question, which was whether the three holes, cartridges, that were found on the sixth floor of the book depository building could have been fired by a Mannlicher Schomauer rifle rather than a Mannlicher Kakana rifle. FBI expert Fraser responded that he was not familiar with the Mannlicher Schomauer rifle, and so he could not express an opinion because he just did not have sufficient knowledge to answer the question. John McCoy responded that he himself owned a Mannlicher Schomauer rifle and that he was familiar with it. The question was never answered in the Warren Commission testimony on ballistics. It was left unanswered, and it leaves open the possibility for further examination whether the shells that were at the National Archives that came from the sixth floor, whether they were indeed Mannlicher Kakana holes. Again, maybe they were Mannlicher Schomauer, I don't know. Pure speculation. In understanding the background of David Harold Byrd and how he came to be the person that he was, I came across the fact that he was a significant U.S. government contractor in the ownership of companies that contracted with the U.S. government. His company, PEMCO, was set up after World War II to continue aviation manufacturing in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Dallas-Fort Worth had been the site of some of the factories in World War II that manufactured bombers during the Roosevelt administration. When the war ended, the people who ran these plants wanted to continue the work, and they approached David Harold Byrd about obtaining financing to be able to continue building planes for the government. And he did finance and took a large ownership stake in PEMCO, which stood for Texas Engineering Manufacturing Company. Research showed that PEMCO became a prime contractor for the Air Force in the field of electronic warfare. This began in the early 1950s, when, with the Korean War, there was a big step up in military contracting, and the Air Force picked five contractors to do sole source contracting for the Air Force to outfit the secret electronics on the Air Force planes that could be used then to fly into hostile airspace or near borders of hostile countries. This was the important reconnaissance function of the Air Force. These planes, the jet version that came out later in the 50s, was the RC-135 reconnaissance plane, and PIMCO, Bird's company, finance and perform the electronics outfitting of the RC-135. The Air Force set up a sole-source non-compete contracting arrangement for five companies. PIMCO was one of the five companies that performed this work. Out of this work, from PIMCO developed a company called E-Systems, and E-Systems stood for the part of PIMCO that was working the electronics for electronic warfare. PIMCO merged with Ling and Vought in 1960, creating a company LPV, Ling PIMCO Vought, that became a large defense contractor in the 1960s. Out of Ling, PIMCO Vought's Electro-Systems developed doing this electronics work, and then the name was changed to E-Systems in the 1960s. E-Systems is well known as a very large CIA contractor and one of the significant ones of that era. Research showed that in 1975, because of the Troops Committee investigation, the CIA needed to sell its Air America proprietary airline. CIA decided it would be best to unload it because of the controversy, so the CIA asked E-Systems if they would buy Air America from the CIA. And by the way, Collins Radio and E-Systems are also linked to a Mr. Mather, it was his red car that was one of the cars being driven by an alleged Oswald impersonator in around the time of the assassination. And by the way, Mr. Mather was also close to J.B. Pippin. Continuing. E-Systems decided that they did not want all of Air America, but they would take the Air America ground maintenance function. And so they bought Air Asia from the CIA in 1975. There are documents on the CIA website that show this, and this shows how close E-Systems was to the CIA. There are also documents on the CIA's website that indicate that when Robert Gates was appointed deputy director of the CIA in the late 1980s, he was making goodwill trips around the country to various cities, and there was a proposed itinerary for Dallas when he went to Dallas, and the proposed itinerary began with a trip, a visit to E-Systems corporate facility in Dallas, and then on to the Dallas Morning News, and then to an appearance at the World Affairs Council in Dallas. So another indication of E-Systems was closely aligned with the CIA, and as I say, E-Systems came out of a company financed by David Harold Byrd doing electronic warfare mechanical work. In addition, the Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth was the headquarters of the 8th Air Force, and the 8th Air Force was the primary bombing organization from the U.S. that was sent to England during World War II to bomb Germany. And it was really the strongest bombing power that the U.S. military had, and the 8th Air Force was commanded at times in World War II by Jimmy Doolittle. And it was affiliated with the Strategic Air Command under Curtis LeMay. Research found a photograph of a VIP inspection of the Carswell Air Force Base in 1949, and that photograph shows Curtis LeMay, Richard Russell, Senator Richard Russell, who was chairman of the Armed Services Committee of the Senate and was on the Warren Commission, Ramey, who was the head of the 8th Air Force, Stuart Symington, who was Secretary of the Air Force in 1949, Lyndon Johnson, U.S. Senator from Texas at the time, and Homer Thornberry, who was a member of the U.S. Congress. The caption for the photograph said there were two other VIPs present who weren't in the photograph. One was Amon Carter, C-A-R-P-E-R, the famous businessman from Fort Worth, and the other was B. Harold Byrd, Vice Chairman of the Civil Air Patrol. This gathering occurred at the inspection of Carswell Air Force Base in 1949. So the conclusion of the research has indicated that there are connections from the ownership of the School Book Depository building to some of the most secret elements of the government, classified elements, and that these are significant connections and that they may have significance in our research and analysis of the information. Well, again, there is quite a lot to contemplate. In not only that paper, again, a wonderful piece of research by Dan Alcorn. I wonder about Werner von Alvensleben, his presence in Dallas in late 63, according to apparently to the Dallas Morning News, and the Mannlicher-Schonauer rifle. Was that how some of the ammunition that the cartridges got into the Texas School Book Depository? I don't know. And again, I wonder why von Alvensleben was not admitted to the U.S. if, in fact, he was an OSS double agent. And, you know, as I contemplate what is taking place in this country, and it is quite remarkable, the continued BS about the JFK assassination, and beyond that, the modified limited hangout of the JFK assassination is really something to contemplate. And I speak here on November 23rd of 2024. Donald Trump has appointed Dr. Oz, the television doctor, to oversee Social Security and Medicare. He has Brainworm Bobby as nominated to head up the HHS. And he just nominated a woman whose name escapes me from Fox News to be Surgeon General. And she apparently feels that one of the great contributions people can make to their own lives is to pray a lot. And I think that's going to be very much in order for many of us who are old folks in the Trump administration. But one of the things that's quite remarkable to me is how the society becomes completely enmeshed in BS. And again, there's so much BS surrounding the JFK assassination. And I hope that the presentation in these last few shows has not been too rapid fire or too dense. Again, I think there's some very interesting things to be contemplated, in particular H. Keith Thompson. He was an Operation High Jump commanded by Admiral Byrd, and apparently Admiral Byrd's activities were managed to an extent by D.H. Byrd. And then H. Keith Thompson, again, a secret rights beings agent, an SS intelligence agent, is Mark Reed Oswald's PR person, Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, in the aftermath of the JFK assassination. But one of the things that looms large to me, and that is the role of television in presenting BS to us. I'm going to put an article with some ruminations by the late science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. By the way, the author of the book The Man in the High Castle about Anaxis. Triumph in World War II. I think such a thing actually took place, but about what television actually does to the brain, and it's terrible. A very good book about the JFK assassination was called Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.B. Pippitt by Joseph McBride, published in softcover by High Power Press from Berkeley, California. And much of the book is devoted to McBride's wonderful exploration of J.B. Pippitt and who may have actually killed J.B. Pippitt, and was J.B. Pippitt perhaps involved in the assassination. But he ruminates in Chapter 3 called Epic Splendor about the role of television in presenting us with the BS version of the JFK assassination. And I think as a reality TV show, TV host Donald Trump begins his second administration as president of the U.S., I think the quote Epic Splendor unquote comes into play. And this chapter begins with a quote from poet Emily Dickinson. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The veteran television newsman Van Mather owed his career to the Kennedy assassination, and it keeps paying dividends for him because he has long been a leading figure in the cover-up. In an unusual and shocking display of candor on CBS's 25th anniversary documentary on the assassination, 4 days in November, Rather described the Kennedy assassination as having been, quote, the answer to my prayers, unquote. Rather's reporting for CBS TV and radio from Dallas in 1963, though often at odds with reality, has provided him with endless material for reminiscing on television and in print about his pivotal role in the assassination coverage. But it was not always the day of the actual shooting that Rather found most significant. On 4 days in November, he offered, quote, a personal note based on the many years CBS News and I have spent investigating, thinking about these 4 days. It was a day we haven't shown that also has a lot of meaning for me. The fifth day, Tuesday. On Tuesday, America went back to work. The Constitution of the U.S. provides for the orderly transition of the presidency, and that's what took place. So it is Tuesday, I often think of. Some 200 million people went about their business, and America continued on course. In fact, the JFK assassination was a coup d'etat. Continuing, and McBride then adds here, on the contrary, I remember that Tuesday as a day of the most profound bleakness and desolation. I returned to high school that day feeling utterly lost. The transition of the presidency I'd seen on television was brutal, not, quote, orderly, unquote. I felt no sense of order or reassurance or triumph, nor did I have any sense that life was, quote, returning to normal, unquote, or that America was, quote, continuing on course, unquote. To believe that would have been a final insult to the memory of President Kennedy. Giving back to our daily business in the wake of the president's murder evidently meant that we were expected to go on as if nothing had happened in a world that had changed in ways we could not yet begin to imagine. And again, the Vietnam War was on track, although we were being lied to about it. And David Harold Byrd, as well as James Ling, were buying stock in LTV. And when the Vietnam War kicked in, that stock helped enrich them. Continuing. Those selling the idea, as many in the media were, that, quote, the system worked, unquote, that the machinery of government was running smoothly, that Kennedy's death was inconsequential, a mere bump in the road caused by the inexplicable actions of a madman, seemed either in denial or disingenuous. The psychological pressure to, quote, get back to normal, unquote, was an assault on an open wound, and if the wound remains open after half a century, the callousness of that assault is a large part of the reason why. At root, the question of whether the assassination was a temporary lapse for American democracy or whether it signaled the start of an ongoing crisis of public trust in our institutions is what divides those who, like Dan Maver, accept the consolatory explanation of events from those who take the tragic view of modern American history. Like many other Americans, I remember feeling without entirely knowing why, but the opposite was true. But America had irrevocably and forever changed. If the agenda of Raver and others in television and radio and the print media was to lay those feelings to rest, it was at most a transitory achievement. There seemed no clarity anymore, no place to stand, no future. Going back to normal seemed a cruel joke. What was normal now? The next section is called A Smooth Transition, and it's in quotes. The three television networks suspended all regular programming and commercials for their four-day marathon of assassination coverage. A viewer in Minneapolis said of the viewing experience, quote, all day Saturday and Sunday I don't remember doing a thing. I didn't get dressed. I didn't make the beds. I didn't dry anything. I didn't do anything, excuse me. Monday we watched all day and cried all day, unquote. Another viewer found the experience almost as compelling but still expressed ambivalences about the coverage. Quote, I walked around the block because I felt if I didn't I was going to scream. I thought I could get away from it for a while, but it was like a magnet, unquote. The coverage concluded with the president's funeral on Monday, November 25th, at the time the most watched event in American history. The Nielsen Company estimated that as many as 93% of the televisions in the country were tuned in during the peak points of the coverage. With most of the nation's 189 people fixated on their television screens, relying on that medium for information and understanding, our new technological worshiping place filled a function of apparent social unification on an unprecedented scale. Remember that. With most of the nation's 189 million people fixated on their television screens, relying on that medium for information and understanding, our new technological worshiping place filled a function of apparent social unification on an unprecedented scale. At the conclusion of this broadcast, I'm going to talk about the hit song Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. That was a first big hit. That song was written in the aftermath of and about the aftermath of the JFK assassination. The next time you hear that song or and look at the lyrics, remember that. Continuing. The saturation coverage was widely praised as cathartic, but this vast, pervasive public spectacle was more like a drug that could only temporarily blunted the pain. Few could have watched Monday's rituals without being deeply moved, as if we were watching a modern version of a Greek tragedy performed for the entire nation and millions of other viewers around the world. But what we were moved by was more than mourning. It was a collective hallucination, a dream of noble purpose in the midst of a shower of gore. The fantasy for American viewers was that we were still one nation, all grouped reverently around our TV sets in an electronic virtual cathedral, pretending that the system still worked. This monumental lie was served upon a grieving nation at a time when it was just beginning to come to terms with the fact that it was living in a nightmare that had taken place of its accustomed, reality. Like most Americans, that long weekend, I was emotionally overwhelmed and to some extent lulled into a state of numbness by the 4 days of television coverage. In a January 1964 article on, quote, America's Long Vigil, unquote, TV Guide made the argument which had become part of the accepted wisdom surrounding the assassination that television healed the country during that ordeal. And I'm quoting from the TV Guide article. As a nation, we were able to live out our grief in concert and at the same time begin the arduous process of... Moreover, we were able to prepare ourselves for the new order of things. At the end of the 4 days, we were to know the new president intimately, who he was, where he came from, and most important of all, how he behaved in a time of extreme stress. That obviously was a big lie, as we looked at in the earlier articles in this program. Continuing. As CBS News anchorman Walter Cronkite was leaving the comment, quote, "We saw before our very eyes a smooth transition of government. No confusion, only a man in command moving ahead for the problems at hand," unquote. This consolatory myth is the big lie of those 4 days. Now, this is McBride going on here. This consolatory myth is the big lie of those 4 days. It bears little resemblance to what actually happened that weekend when the government of the U.S. was violently overthrown by persons who, as I write this now almost 50 years later, have yet to be punished for the crime. It was hard to have any perspective on the dizzyingly intense and often confounding coverage of the developments in the case, but some moments of that long weekend's television coverage stood out with more startling clarity and more unsettling dissonance, as if a curtain were briefly being pulled back on something hidden, something that made our country seem different from what we had thought it was. Television, quote, "helped to narcotize behavior that might have been dangerous by exhausting the need for action," unquote. William A. Mindack and Gerald B. Hirsch observe in their chapter, quote, "television's functions on the assassination weekend in the 1965 Stanford University Press study, the Kennedy assassination, and the American social communication crisis." And then a quote from that, "After the assassination, television most conspicuously contributed to the enforcement and affirmation of social norms and values. Faith in the future of the country, belief in the form and continuity of the government, these are the cornerstones of the American value system. Allied to these values are canonization of the presidency, esteem for dignity and courage, and reverence for the dead. The comments of 93% of those interviewed show that television reawakened these values for them. Television furnished undeniable evidence of the continuing vitality of the American government. So poignantly did television accentuate the pain of the assassination, yet at the same time immobilize the impulse to act, that normal social and introspective outlets were generally ignored. In this study, we found that the people who on Friday exhibited emotional reactions that usually precede collective disorder appear to have acquired after the funeral a more realistic appraisal of the assassination's implications for the future of the country. Although people were reassured of the stability of the government and inspired by the conduct of the Kennedy family, they experienced a restless urgency for release from television and, quote, this mounting depression, unquote. By Monday, 3/4 of the respondents said that they were finding comfort in the realization that the nation would go on much as before. Well, it didn't. Contender McBride continues, what we experienced in front of our television that weekend was, in effect, a remarkably sophisticated 4-day docudrama about the assassination, the first of many attempts to shape and package the chaotic events into a manageable, dramatic, and ideological form. The spectacular television extravaganza, a live drama on the unprecedentedly outsized canvas in and duration offered a shockingly violent opening featuring the, quote, unexpected, unquote, death of the protagonist, suspenseful twists and turns, a lurid cast of characters, and most importantly, a simplistic, neatly tied up conclusion, including the death of the antagonist on the third day and the reassurance by the end of the fourth that the state, although wounded, still survived. Have had all the elements of a Hollywood production on a scale of showmanship that would be unrivaled until Oliver Stone made his historical film JFK 28 years later to re-argue the case for conspiracy made by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison and other investigators. Stone has Garrison tell the courtroom, quote, the official legend is created and the media takes it from there. The glitter of official lies and the epic splendor of the thought-numbing funeral of JFK confuse the eye and confound the understanding. And again, it most assuredly did. Now, bear in mind, again, the song, as I mentioned, The Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. It was the first big hit, and it was written in the aftermath of and about the aftermath of the JFK assassination. And I haven't got time here. And I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to sing some of the lyrics, but thinking about where what they talk about, where it says people talking without speaking, people listening, people talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never shared, no one dared disturb the wells. People writing songs that voices never shared, no one dared disturb the sounds of silence. And then they go on to say, and the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made, and the sign flashed out its warning, gave the word that it was forming. The words of the prophets are written on the subway walls and tenement halls and echoed in the sounds of silence. Yes, indeed, they were. This concludes For the Record program number 1361, Birds of a Feather, being recorded on November 23rd of the year 2024. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.